my name is Sam, and I'm here to introduce one of the bravest individuals that I've ever met, Lear Keith. First of all, Lear is the author of 6 books, including The Vegetarian Myth, Food Justice, and Sustainability, which has been called the most important ecological book of this generation. She's also the co-author of a strategy manual entitled Deep Green Resistance, which actually puts forward a strategy that could pose a real threat to the industrial systems which are destroying life on this planet. Lear has been arrested 6 times for acts of political resistance, and she continues to be one of the only public figures who is naming industrial civilization as the root problem of the environmental issues that we face, and actually advocating for decisive action against it. So, in other words, Lear has made it her life work to advocate for a strategy that actually works. And for those of us who aim to win, we know how important a working strategy actually is. And in doing this work, Lear has inspired thousands, including me, to take on the struggle alongside of her. And I'm sure that many of the people in this room feel the same way. But I'd like to acknowledge that it's no secret that Lear's work has stirred up a lot of controversy, and loudly so. But a friend of mine once said that if you're ever trying to find where the real work is happening, then you should first look out for the fireworks. And Lear has brought fireworks to this city, but true to form, through all the noise, she hasn't lost sight of the very difficult task ahead. So without further ado, here she is.
Devours with an entitlement so profound, it is turning the planet to dust. That dust is not hyperbole. The dust storms in China, the inevitable endpoint of agriculture. The dust storms are so bad, they're triggering asthma in children in Colorado. So here's the dust, it's leaving China, and here it is landing in Aspen. I know it's unbearable. Reality is an avalanche of grief right now. But I'm asking each of you to take your heart out of cold storage. You put it there for safekeeping, I know. But there is no safety on a planet being murdered. In French, the word for heart, that's the root of our word for courage. To face the facts, we will need our hearts. And to face down power, which is what everyone in this room is proposing, a modest proposal it is not. We will need all the courage of which our hearts are capable. Because that power is huge. It's a vast and global system that has gone rabid with destruction. And it's called civilization. Now that word, civilization, that just means people living in cities. What that actually means is that they need more than the land can give. So food, water, energy, they have to come from somewhere else. From that point forward, it doesn't matter what lovely, beautiful, peaceful values people might hold in their hearts. That society is dependent on imperialism and genocide. Because no one willingly gives up their land, their water, their trees. But since the city has used up its own, it has to go out and get those from somewhere else. And that's the last 10,000 years in a few sentences. Okay, the central concept here is drawdown. If you use more wood than a forest can grow, eventually the forest will be gone. If you take fish faster than they can spawn, the day will come when that river is nothing but water and sorrow. And then there are things that don't reproduce, things like oil, things like coal. Using them at all means using them up. It can only be drawn down. Now, you can blow up mountains to get to the last of it, but now you're drawing down mountains as well as coal, and at the end of the day, it's still gone. Okay, this isn't a differential equation. It's not even algebra. It's basic arithmetic. If you have one planet, one cradle of air, one blanket of soil, right? One place you call home, and you destroy it, it's 1 minus 1. Our planet needs us to do the math. No one seems willing. They could put a man on the moon, they can't do 1 minus 1. And our planet needs us to be, in the words of the inimitable James Howard Kunstler, reality-based adults. That 1 minus 1 isn't a surprise. It didn't sneak up on us. It's been going on for 10,000 years. In fact, it's the longest war ever. It's the pattern of civilization, over and over and over. There's a bloated power center surrounded by conquered colonies from which that center extracts what it wants. And then it collapses. And that collapse takes between 800 and 2,000 years. It lasts until the soil gives out. Because the primary activity of civilization is agriculture. So, you have to understand what agriculture is. In very brute terms, you take a piece of land, you clear every living thing off it, and I mean down to the bacteria, and then you plant it to human use. So, it's biotic cleansing. It's also not a plan of the future because it's drawdown. And one of the main things you're drawing down is fossil soil. To give you a number, one season of planting your basic row crop, so corn or soy or wheat, you can destroy 2,000 years of soil. Make no mistake, the planet has been skinned alive, and what should be habitat for millions of creatures turns to salt and dust. So this is a wrap. It's one of the places where agriculture started. No one in their right mind would call this place the Fertile Crescent now. This is Iran, so 94% of the ag land is degraded. In the background, that's not a mountain range. That's soil that's been turned to dust. Pakistan, one-third. 150 years ago, this was a teak forest. And here's poor China again. This is inevitable. Okay, this isn't agriculture on a bad day. This isn't agriculture done poorly. It's what agriculture is. You pull down the forest, you rip up the prairie, you drain the wetland, you exsanguinate the world of water and soil and species, the process of life itself. Now, a lot of people get very confused here. It's not our fault. This is a profound cultural ignorance about the material base of our culture, okay, about what agriculture is. So I want to walk you through this because I want you to hate me. Okay, that was a joke. My only joke. Yeah. I actually don't care whether you hate me. That's not the point. The point is, I want the people who care the most about this planet to actually understand the depth of the problem, because we will never come up with solutions if we don't understand the scale of this. That's what I want. So I'm going to bring this home. Think about what's outside your kitchen window. Now, most likely you have a couple of trees or you have a little patch of lawn. You have either a mini forest or a micro prairie. Now, let's say you want to grow some corn or some lettuce. You can't just throw those seeds around and hope for the best. Corn and lettuce are never going to outcompete trees and grass. Okay? That's never. You already know what you have to do. If you want corn or lettuce, you have to chop down the tree, you gotta dig up the lawn, right? You pull down the forest, you plow up the prairie. You have to destroy that biotic community. When I was 20, I had a biology professor who told me the truth in one sentence. The moment you put a pile to soil, you destroy that soil. In that sentence, I watched it all collapse. All these people need to be fed, The only way to feed them is to do agriculture, to take more and more land. But agriculture is the destruction of that land. So every day, we are digging a deeper grave. I saw it, but I couldn't follow it to the end. It was too horrible. So I ran. I ran from that knowledge. But it followed me, like any good truth. It wouldn't let me go. That was the angel I wrestled for 20 years. And there was only the grimace of blessings to be won. This is not a liberatory truth. It is not a salvatory truth. It's like a wound that can corrode the soul. You all know what I'm talking about. There were whales once in the Mediterranean. There were elephants in China. There were so many bison on the Great Plains, you could sit on a rock for 4 days watching the herd thunder by. There were so many water birds in the Central Valley in California, they blocked out the sun. This is who has been taken from you here in this place. The Cascade Mountains wolf, the Tacoma pocket gopher, the Oregon bison. The trees that were 20 feet in diameter, the Shastrian flowers, whose names we will never know, and all of them should ache like the phantom loom. And then there are the rivers, full of ghosts. 10 million fish have been reduced to 10,000. This may be the saddest 2 sentences ever. No agency or entity officially declared Snake River Coho extinct, although many acknowledged it after the fact. The fish simply were gone, and very few people noticed. Once, you could hear them coming for hours. There are people alive who still remember this. You could hear the fish for hours before they arrived. And I have never once heard the sound that water makes when 40 million years of persistence finds its way home. Let me tell you who else may be taking forever. The Humboldt Martin and the Pacific Fisher, the Coast Range Fawn Lily and the Columbian White-tailed Deer, the Willamette Daisy and the Western Snowy Plover, the Oregon Silver Spot Butterfly. There are lists of the damned. You will need your hearts to face this. I know what I'm asking. But better a broken heart than no heart at all. Because even a broken heart is still made of love. And here we are at the end of the world. You pull down the forest, you rip up the prairie. 1 minus 1. 98% of the old growth forests are gone, and 99% of the world's prairies. There's nothing left to take. Jared Diamond, who won the Pulitzer Prize, he said that agriculture is the biggest mistake the human race has ever made. Toby Hemingway said that sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron, and Richard Manning uses the exact same phrase. I'll let him take it from here. No biologist, or anyone else for that matter, could design a system of regulations that would make agriculture sustainable. Sustainable agriculture is an oxymoron. It mostly relies on an unnatural system of annual grasses grown in a monoculture, a system that nature does not sustain or even recognize as a system. We sustain it with plows, petrochemicals, fences, and subsidies because there is no other way to sustain it. Agriculture is how we've been destroying the planet, but it's like we want to save the world without ever knowing it. Now, civilization has destroyed human cultures as well. It's the beginning of militarism, and it's the beginning of slavery. So agricultural societies end up militarized, and they always do for 3 reasons. 1, agriculture creates a surplus. Temporary, but a surplus. If it can be stored, it can be stolen. So someone has to guard it. 2 is imperialism. Agriculture is a war against the natural world. Eventually, the agriculturalists need more. They need more land, more water, more trees. So there's this entire class of people whose job is war, whose job is to go out and get those resources and bring them back by force. Agriculture makes that possible. It also makes it inevitable. And 3 is slavery. Agriculture is backbreaking labor. for anyone to have leisure time, they need slaves. By the year 1800, when the fossil fuel age began, fully three-quarters of the human beings alive on this planet were living in some form of slavery, indenture, or serfdom. Three-quarters. Now, the only reason we've forgotten that is because we've been using fossil fuel to do that work. And of course, once you have huge numbers of the population in slavery, you need someone to keep them there, and so soldiers. Now, this is a cycle that we've been on for 10,000 years. I want to make sure to state this. This disaster is not a function of human nature. It's a function of human choices. Lauren Bourdain, who's an expert in Paleolithic nutrition, he uses the image of a football field to bring this home. If that the whole length of that field is our time on Earth, the last half yard represents the time that we've been doing agriculture. That's it, that last half yard. And in fact, that last one-fifth of an inch is the Industrial Revolution. We lived on this planet for 2.5 million years without destroying it. We were participants, like everyone else. The ruling religion of this planet is called patriarchy. The very creation of Western civilization tells men to dominate, to conquer, to go forth and multiply. No hunter-gatherer is told by God to willfully overshoot the land's carrying capacity, and no marginally rational person would listen to such a thought. But that is what we are up against, and we are going to have to say this out loud. This is a culture of profound entitlement based on a masculine violation imperative. That imperative includes breaking the sexual boundaries of women and children, the cultural and political boundaries of indigenous people, the biological boundaries of rivers and forests, the genetic boundaries of other species, the physical boundaries of the atom itself. You put all this together, the entire culture is sociopathic. The entitlement, the sadism, that bottomless hunger to conquer, you'll never reach the end of it. What we are reaching is complete biotic collapse, starting with the least of us. The plankton populations are collapsing now. It's because the oceans are too acidic, so the plankton can't reproduce. Maybe plankton are too small and too green for most people to care about, but you should know this. 2 out of 3 animal breaths are made possible by the oxygen that plankton produce. So if the oceans go down, we go down with them. So what do? We fight right now. Okay, you've heard of speed dating? This is speed revolution. So, a couple of basic concepts you're going to need to get through this. So the cardinal difference is between liberals and radicals. Now, liberals believe that society is made up of individuals. So that's the basic social unit, is the individual. And in this view, being identified as a member of the group, that's harm. Okay, so saying that people are a member of the group, that is what causes harm. But radicals, it's totally different. Radicals see society as made up of groups of people, classes of people. And in Marx's original version, this supports economic class, but it's any caste or any group. And some of those groups have power over other groups. So for radicals, being a member of the group, that's not an affront, far from it. It's recognizing your position in that group is actually the first step toward political consciousness and ultimately effective action. So the solution to oppression is always embedded in the problem. You make common cause with the people who share the condition. So the other big division is on the nature of social reality. Liberalism is what's called idealist. So social reality is made up of attitudes, of ideas, and that means that social change happens through education, right? It happens through rational argument. Now, on the radical side, it's materialism. And that means that society is actually made up of concrete systems of power. Not thoughts and ideas, but material institutions. So for radicals, the solution to oppression is actually to take those systems apart brick by brick. So the liberals say, well, we have to educate, educate, educate. And the radicals will say, actually, we have to stop them. So if you remove power from the equation, which is what liberalism does, oppression is voluntary, which erases the fact that it's social subordination. People withstand oppression using three psychological Subordination produces consent. That's what it does. So do not ever confuse consent with liberation. And this is about the most poignant, talk about this is from Harriet Tubman, where she said, "I could have freed hundreds more if they had, but none, they were slaves." So that's the consent right there. So this is the realization to which radicalism will bring you. Social change requires force. Why? Because it's not a mistake out of which the powerful can be educated. Now don't misunderstand me. This is not about violence versus nonviolence. That comes much later. It's only to recognize that power is not a mistake. It's not a misunderstanding. It's not a disagreement. So justice is not won by rational argument, by individual transformation, or by spiritual epiphany. It's won by taking power away from the powerful and dismantling the institutions that created it. Okay, so there's three broad categories of response to oppressive conditions. You've legal remedies, direct action, and withdrawal. Now, these categories can overlap in ways that are crucial to resistance movements. They can also be diversions that dead end. None of them are definitively liberal or radical. And if you walk away with nothing else from this talk, this is the point I want you to remember. All of these categories have key strategic strengths if we understand them strategically. So, legal. Most activist groups are centered around legal remedies to address specific harms. And that's for very good reason. As Catherine McKinnon points out, law organizes power. The trick is we need to do this as radicals, which means asking these questions. Does the initiative redefine power, not just sit at the top of the pyramid? Does it take away the rights of the oppressors, reestablish the rights of the dispossessed? Does it let people control the material conditions of their lives? Okay, number two is direct action. So actionists can also target other arrangements of power, not just the legal ones. And that circumvents the law entirely. So, great example, Montgomery bus boycott, right? They use economic pressure instead of legal pressure. And as with legal remedies, the goal of direct action can be anywhere from liberal to downright revolutionary. Okay, and finally, we have withdrawal. Now, the major difference between withdrawal as a successful strategy and withdrawal as a failed strategy is whether that withdrawal is linked to political resistance or whether it's seen as adequate itself. And that difference hinges precisely on the distinction between liberal and radical. So issues of identification, loyalty, it's crucial to building that class consciousness needed for a resistance movement, but that alone is not enough. The withdrawal has got to go beyond the intellectual, the emotional, the psychological, to include a goal of actually doing justice. Withdrawal may give solace, but ultimately it will change nothing. And living in a rarefied bubble world of the converted is a poor substitute for freedom. Such a world will certainly not save our planet. Okay, so there's a pattern across resistance struggles. First, you have the creation of what I call a culture of resistance. So that culture, it encourages self-respect, class consciousness, loyalty to your own, breaking the identification with the oppressor, and calling for new norms of behavior, both psychologically and collectively. Few examples. This was a movement called the Gaelic Revival that started in the late 19th century, and it precedes the struggle for Irish independence, very self-consciously. These people said point blank, we will never win our independence from England without doing this first. So it's a complete redefinition of what it means to be Irish. And this leads directly into sort of the first shot across the bow in the independence movement, which was the land war. So very successful use of nonviolent resistance. This was a struggle to get the land actually back into the hands of the people who actually lived there. And this was the beginning of the movement for independence. Okay, so another example. Harlem Renaissance. You've got the exact same pattern. A redefinition of what it means to be black. The black experience is centered in the Harlem Renaissance. So the music, the poetry, the literature, all of this is completely recentering what it means to be black in the United States. And within a generation, you get civil rights movement. If you don't know who this is Little Ruby Bridges, and she pretty much single-handedly desegregated the Louisiana public school system. And I love this picture because I'm sure like many of you, you hear all the time, we can do nothing. It is too late. It is too big. Nothing we do is going to work. And it's the rending of clothes and the wailing and the pulling of hair. there and complete despair about how bad things are, and I get that. But I see this picture, and I think we have no right to this kind of despair when a six-year-old child can produce this kind of courage. She wrote a great memoir, by the way, of what this experience was. Another great example, this is the so-called Great Awakening, a national awakening in the Baltic countries, and this leads again right into the Baltic independence movement. Now, it took them a little bit longer, but you know, they had World War I, World War II, Nazi Soviets, eventually, yes, though. They get the independence movement. So this was 1989. They made a human chain that was 600 kilometers long through all three Baltic nations, 2 million people linked hands. You should know there's only 8 million people in the Baltic, so 25% of the population did this. And from that point forward, independence was inevitable. So, a true culture of resistance is self-consciously the cradle of the resistance movement. It believes in resistance. It encourages it, plans for it, supports it, and then prepares for its ultimate victory. And that's the difference between culture as a successful part of resistance and culture as a dead end into irrelevance and despair. So throughout history, you've got a culture of resistance that builds the institutions that can organize a new society as the old one comes down. And then you've got the combatants doing the direct confrontation to power. And we need lots and lots of people to do the standard work that cultures of resistance do. We also need to repair the vast biotic communities that have been destroyed. This work will involve huge numbers of people in many different organizations, all of them above ground and non-violent. So, local economies, participatory democracy, systems of justice, and character building, and ultimately, of course, there's direct support for the frontline actionists. But the vast majority of people aren't going to resist shit, and I think we just need to accept that. Of those that do, it's still only a tiny number that ever take up those frontline positions. That's actually true in regular armies. It's only about 2% that have the direct combat roles. The other 98% do support. That's the ratio of combatants to support personnel, whether it's an army or a resistance movement. That 2% is about what's needed. Most people aren't going to take that up. They don't have the personality for it, or they can't take the risks for really legitimate reasons. And that's fine, because the support personnel are crucial to all of this. But you know, all of this, the last 30 minutes, all of this has been for you who are the 2%. Because you're the people I want to talk to. We need warriors who will put themselves between what is left of this planet and fossil fuel. We need to stop industrial civilization. Now that could be done non-violently. If we had enough people, we could shut this party down by midnight using human blockades. The problem is, I don't see the numbers. Not anywhere. I would love to be wrong. I would vastly prefer to wage this struggle non-violently. But my longing will not bring forth the necessary numbers. So given a realistic assessment of what we actually have, the only viable strategy left that I can see is direct attacks against infrastructure. In the plainest terms, we need to stop them. We need an underground organization with the training, the discipline, the command structure, and the strategic smarts to coordinate decisive action on a continental scale, and we needed it yesterday. And it would be really great if the permaculture wing will get on board and provide that culture of resistance, especially the loyalty and the material support. At the very least, I wish people would stop saying that it can't be done. It can. The real question is, why aren't we doing it? That's not a rhetorical question. I think there are multiple answers, some that speak well of us and some that don't. But as people of conscience, justice is our deepest wish. Right? It's our North Star. And we know it's opposite. We know what violence feels like. Intimate, shattering, and permanent. We want to draw a line firmly and forever, a line that is really a protective circle between human beings in all our soft, mammalian vulnerability and violence. We need that line because every single one of us should be inside that circle. I know what I'm asking, but every living creature is asking too. On a scale that defies viewing, mountains are falling, the oceans are dying. The climate itself is bleeding out, and it's your children who will see if it's beyond repair. So here is the question, from what is left of this planet to us, do we have thousands of people ready to shut down the industrial economy? Because that is what has to be done. And that's what it would take, body after body, day after day, standing between the plankton, the plovers, the mountains themselves, and the rancid sadism of power. It could be done. This was the French labor strike of 2010. Thousands of people turned out to protest austerity measures. Now, they had a different goal, but that's not my point. The point is they almost brought the economy to a halt. They blockaded fuel depots, they closed 30 oil refineries, and also the major oil terminal. The French strikers did what every military and every insurgency does. They interrupted keynotes of infrastructure. They were well on their way to shutting down the entire economy, and they did it using nonviolence. So it could be done. We could stop the industrial economy. We could stop the murder of everything if we had enough people. But we don't. I don't arrive at this moment with any joy, but this is where history has brought me and abandoned me. No one has ever had to make decisions before about the murder of everything, about the end of life itself. I can't turn away from my moral agency to ease my moral agony. And meanwhile, what I'm telling you, at the very least, could we consider some strategies that might match the scale? Okay, these are written with your tax dollars, so you might as well read them. Just saying. Direct attacks on infrastructure are highly effective. The reason you can learn about asymmetric warfare at places like West Point and the U.S. Army and training camps all over the world is because it works. The principles have been honed for decades. So, coordinated multiple attacks. What you're ultimately after is called cascading systems. And that's how you get there. Coordinated multiple attacks against nodes of infrastructure. That's exactly what the French labor strike did. They did it nonviolently because they did lots of people, but it's the same principle. And the whole endeavor depends on one thing. Target selection. Okay, so four things to consider. How important is the target? How tough is the target? Can you get to the target? And what would it cost the enemy to replace that target? So now some things began to make sense. I essentially wasted my youth because I didn't know this. One of the reasons that many resistance movements have no decisive success is that the targets have low criticality, high recuperability. That's very typical for resistance groups that like training, which is most of us. Targets are chosen for their accessibility, right? You can get to them. But those targets aren't in any way critical, and they're easily repaired. That would be your basic McDonald's window strategy. I say this as someone who has smashed a share of windows. I destroyed thousands of dollars of property, and we were brave and committed and righteous. We were glorious with rage. It was pointless. Why? Low criticality, higher durability. Breaking that window doesn't stop those bad people from doing the bad things. Not for a second. We have got to stop thinking like vandals and start thinking like field officers. And yes, I understand the implications of what I'm suggesting. I can insist that the distinction between property and people is obvious and absolute, but I know what can go wrong. Even with every ethical bulwark in place against harm to sentient beings, I know what can go wrong. It's too easy for ideology to tighten into fanaticism and unmoor our basic moral precepts. And extremism has its own addictive thrills. History of the pile of bodies attesting to that, I know. But I weigh that knowledge against the Cascade Mountains wolf and the Coho salmon and the longest night of extinction. I weigh that knowledge against the certainty that our one and only home lush with life and the promise of more, will soon be a bare rock if we do nothing. And I know everyone in this room is working as hard as you can, but carbon reached 400 parts per million this year. How much time do we have left? 5 generations of salmon? 3 generations of plovers? 1 generation of humans? I think it's possible to draw a line that's absolute between people and property, between sentience and objects, and never forget. But maybe I have to believe that, because I see an emergency the size of land and sea and sky, and no other options. So I got 2 small offerings to my own moral grief. The Maine British Suffrage Organization, the WSPU, did you know that they took up arson? Tired of being tortured in prison, they escalated from civil disobedience. They burned down train stations, they blew up golf courses, and they set fire to historic buildings with no loss of life. They hurt no one, and they won the vote. It was called sheer madness, and it split the movement. But not a single human was hurt. In our own lifetimes, we have the Earth Liberation Front. They had waged a 30-year campaign of property destruction, some of it quite serious, and have never once lost their way across that line to harm a single human. So how could it be done? Well, this is MED, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta. I want to be clear, I do not support everything these people have done. I'm not valorizing this group, but target selection toward cascading systems failure, oh yes, this they have done well. The Niger Delta is the world's largest wetland, only it could more reasonably be called a sludge land now. The indigenous people are knee-deep in oil industry waste. The fish are devastated, and the people are sick and starving. There's been widespread non-violent resistance to the oil industry, but men took up other tactics. They do direct attacks on rigs, pipelines, bridges, support facilities, and different vessels. They've reduced Nigeria's oil output by a dramatic 1/3, and that's permanent. In one attack, they reduced the oil by 10%, and in a series of attacks across 1 week, they reduced the oil by 80%. They do surprise attacks against simultaneous targets toward that goal of disrupting the entire system of production. So cascading systems failure. These people are quite serious. They have college educations, they've studied other militant movements, and they number a few hundred. Now understand, a few hundred people, well-trained and organized, have reduced the oil output of Nigeria by a third. There's at least that many people in this room. So it could be done. Hold on to that thought for as long as you can bear it. It could be done. History may have abandoned us here, but I am not abandoning my people. There are tree frogs outside my house, despite the global amphibian die-off. And every time it rains, they sing. And I hear what they're saying. That the world is green and wet and wondrous, and it's ready. We also have spotted owl on our land. I've heard him calling. He is pushed to the absolute edge of the refugia. There's no hope for him, but he keeps trying. There's also a mountain lion at my front door. and I think anyone but a male cougar knows to stay far, far away when they hear that call. She's fertile, she's female, and she's saying one thing. Life wants to live fiercely. They aren't just scenery, and they aren't my neighbors. They're my kin. Look, the facts as they stand. Our planet is dying. Actually, she's being drawn a cord. We're on the verge of complete biotic collapse. Did you know there are parts of China in which there are no longer any flowering plants? No flowering plants. That is 500 million years of evolution. Complete biotic collapse. We need to start thinking like a serious resistance movement because this is a war. I know it feels like daily life. It's been going on for 10,000 years. The lights are on. The cupboards are full. But it's war. And if anyone is left alive 100 years from now to look back, they are going to wonder, what the fuck was wrong with us? We didn't fight like hell and our planet was going down. Think of something